What's going on, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls? It is Friday, April 5th, 2024. And I am your host, as always, The Pody. What's going on, party people? Apologies for last week. I just didn't have time to get an episode out. So I do apologize for that. If you live on the East Coast, New Jersey, down to, I guess, from Maryland, I heard, all the way up to like Boston or even as high up as Vermont or Maine, you felt that earthquake today. And I was less than an hour ago sitting at the dinner table with my parents, and we actually felt an aftershock. So that was pretty wild. I was at work today, never experienced an earthquake in my life. Apparently, this is like the biggest earthquake in like 200 years in this area, 4.8 magnitude earthquake that came out of Lebanon, New Jersey, so which isn't that far from me. So that was scary. I'm at work and legitimately, you know, I thought something exploded. I work at like a school, you know, and I thought that maybe a, you know, a gas line or maybe some construction type of thing was going on somewhere outside or whatever. I don't know. My mind was just racing, and it started with a low, like little vibrating rumble. And I was kind of like, what is that? And then boom, everything starts shaking. Right. And I had one coworker in the office with me, and we're like, what the heck was that? Was that an earthquake? And then we look outside to make sure everything's okay. What the heck just happened? And sure enough, yeah, it was an earthquake, 4.8 magnitude. And even when I was at the dinner table, I kind of looked at my mom. She kind of stopped eating because I could tell something was off. Like she felt something first. And then I could kind of start to hear it, like almost like that dog whistle, how only dogs could hear the dog whistle. Start to hear a little like something very faint, like a vibrating, like little hiss noise. And then sure enough, things started to rumble for a good 5-10 seconds. And luckily nothing fell or broke this time. The one earlier in the day, nobody was home. I was at work. I'm texting my mom that there was an earthquake. She was driving, didn't know really much about it. Then she got home and found out the destruction or the aftermath in our house of what transpired, what took place. You know, a couple pictures. Well, a mirror fell. She had a Disney Mickey and Minnie in like this car. It was a Lennox thing. The ear broke off, and some other doll piece of ceramic thing fell off in our TV room. So yeah, it was weird. Crazy. Who would have thought on just Friday, April 5th, 2024, we'd have one of the biggest earthquakes ever in New Jersey history. I mean, they date back to the records date back to like the late 1700s, 1770s. And I don't really know how they were calculating, you know, magnitudes of earthquakes back in the 1700s. But apparently this is like the third largest one and the biggest in like 200 years or something to that effect. So pretty darn crazy. The aftershocks, there could be more. Who knows? But yeah, we just had one less than an hour ago. And it's freaky, man. Never experienced anything like it. Didn't know what was really happening. I mean, you know what an earthquake is when you feel it. But at the very beginning, you're kind of like, are we under attack? Like, what's going on? Is a plane hitting us? Like, is a train going by? What? This is not normal. So, yeah, very strange, to say the least. So, dealing with that. Also, the weather here has been just absolutely ungodly. This is, like, the worst spring I've ever can ever remember. We've had crazy rain and winds the last couple of days. We were supposed to go up to New York to play some softball games tomorrow. That's been washed out. We had a planned overnight trip. We were going to stay in a hotel, and then Sunday we were coming back into New Jersey, coming back to play another team in our region in a doubleheader. Those two games are still on, but the games up in New York have been canceled and put on the back burner for now. And we haven't played in like a week, so it's been rough. The weather's been terrible. I was off on my spring break because I, you know, work in a school. So we had spring break this past week, and we actually had to make up yesterday and today, which were half days because of the crazy snow we've had this winter and just rain and things like that, that we had days off of school from. So yeah, it's been crazy. I was ready to go back to work. Although once I was back, I was like, yeah, maybe I wasn't so ready to come back, and I'd like to go back to my bed. But that's all I was doing. You never feel good. Like, I'm not the type of person that's going to, that has any initiative, really. So, like, on days where it's raining, or really days that I'm off, I'm just going to sit inside and watch TV and lay in bed, and that's never good. Because, you know, you just eat and then you lay back down and you feel bloated and you just feel groggy. And I had a headache like every day. And it's just like, what am I doing? I'm watching TV, reading some, playing a little bit of video games, but I wasn't really accomplishing anything. And I was bored and just ready to, I couldn't find really much in the way of like good television or movies to watch. Nothing new has really come out. I did binge watch The Brother's Son on Netflix. A little disappointed to find out that they are not renewing that for a second season. I watched a movie called The Postcard Killings or Postcard Killer or something like that. That's like a James Patterson book turned into a movie from a few years back. That was pretty good. Just catching up on Survivor, Amazing Race from the other night, just things like that. Watching, of course, Yankees off to a hot start, although not so hot today. They lost to the Blue Jays. Of course, we've got, you know, March Madness. We've narrowed that down to the final four teams or eight teams, including both men and women. So I'll talk about that because we've got the women's final four tonight or in just like an hour or two. And I definitely want to watch I want to watch the second game between Iowa and UConn more so than the NC State and South Carolina game. But that's also got some good dynamics going in that game with, you know, South Carolina, the odds on favorite at 36-0 right now. See if they can be upset by, you know, NC State, the 3 seed. But anyway, with that being said, you know, it's been 7 minutes now. Enough of me blabbering on about the earthquake and things going on here in my life. Let's talk about what's going on in sports, because that's what you're tuning in for, and that's why you came to listen. So here we go. Okay, so we'll start with the NCAA tournament or March Madness, and we'll start with the biggest Cinderella team. I just mentioned them on the women's side, NC State. There are two teams in the Final Four this year, from the same school in both the men's and the women's side. You have UConn men and women are in the Final Four, and NC State men and women are in the Final Four. Now, this is elite company. This has happened before, but it's only happened maybe less than a dozen times or so. A lot of times it's been UConn. South Carolina's done it twice. Maybe Kentucky's done it. Auburn might have done it. Teams like that. But a lot of UConn. It's very difficult. It's only happened a couple of times where both the men and women win in the same year. I know it happened with UConn a couple times. It's elite company. And this is the first time since 2017 that we've had two teams from the same school on, you know, both the men and women make the Final Four. And we actually had two schools do it this year. So that's wild. But speaking of NC State, they're the only double digit seed remaining on either the men's or women's bracket. And actually, speaking of brackets, according to Kamala Harris, the women just started having brackets in 2022. Sad to think that, her and Joe Biden got 80 million votes, but that's neither here nor there. My women's bracket is, 99.1%. I'm ranked 32,000. I've got South Carolina beating Iowa. I know I didn't really pick any upsets there, but I also picked UConn on the men's side. I didn't pick upsets because I know who's going to win, and I'm pretty good at predicting this dang thing, which I was very locked in on this year. But I did pick the upset of, Oregon State beating Notre Dame, I believe it was. Yeah, Oregon State beating Notre Dame. I had that upset there. I did not have the NC State upset of Stanford, unfortunately. So that was my lone screw up there. But I'd like to see how far I can take this thing and see how close to the top spot I can finish, because I definitely think that's pretty cool for sure. So, let's talk NC State men on the men's side, of course. And I mean, is there anybody more fascinating, besides, of course, you know, the obvious one in Zach Edey, but is there anyone more fascinating than my man, DJ Burns Jr.? Now, I will, full disclosure, I had NC State in the Elite Eight, and I think if I would have picked them to make the Final Four, I would win my bracket pool, that my one pool that I'm in, because I have UConn winning it all, but I don't have enough points to win it. Once UConn wins, I'm a little behind one or two other people that had UConn, and I'm just annoyed because I needed Tennessee to pull off the upset of Purdue. They didn't do that, so now my bracket is burned, and the best I could do is finish second or third, which isn't gonna win me anything. But DJ Burns, man, what a cool story. I was looking him up today. He led the Wolfpack in scoring. He had 29 points, but he's just one of those big dudes. He's 6'9", 275, and he looks like a football. He looks like a football player, and you just don't expect the nimbleness or the athleticism from a guy that size. But he can pass. He has some really quick spin moves down on the baseline, and he's got a really nice little turnaround hook shot. He's decent from the foul line. You know, he's just a joy to watch. And he helped, NC State beat Duke now for the second time in what, like 2 weeks? Because they beat him in the ACC tournament, and now they beat him in the Elite Eight, 76-64. It was a really good second half by them. And, you know, it's crazy because Duke, you know, in Coach K's final year, they've had a tough go of it in this tournament the last couple of years. In Coach K's final year, he loses in the Final Four to North Carolina, right? And then in... fast forward 2 years later, they lose to another in-state rival in NC State in the Elite Eight. So, you know, and it's very fitting because, you know, it's neither here nor there, but Jared McCain, I am not a fan of his, you know, little side act, if you will, that he puts on, the whole TikTok stuff. He paints his nails. It's not my cup of tea. He's a great basketball player. He's got a future. He's probably a lottery pick or close to it. He's only a freshman, but he's a one and done type of guy. He can ball. He led all scorers in this game, I believe, with 31, I want to say. And, you know, I don't like the shenanigans, if you will. And I'm more of an old school guy. If I, you know, was coaching, that's not something that I would like to see. But I think it's weird. I'm not a fan of the whole painting the nails thing. I think it's a little out there, and I know a lot of people agree with me, but it doesn't matter. It's just, you know, I think that's my personal preference, which is fine. I'm entitled to my opinion. You might have your own, but me personally, that's not something that I would want to see, whether I'm a coach, a teammate of his, or whatever, right? But it takes nothing away from him as a player. Like I said, he's going to make millions of dollars. He's making millions of dollars. He's got over 2 million followers on TikTok. He's going to be a lottery pick, or a first round top 10 pick at least, top 15 pick at worst. And it's neither here nor there, but I think it was a little bit, and I'm a Duke guy, so that's what's weird. I found myself rooting against Duke for a while now because of this kid, and it's just because of the singing and like the weird, just the stuff he does. It's not my vibe, you know. What is he, Gen Z, or I can't keep up anymore, but just not my cup of tea. And I was rooting against him for that because I just thought, listen, the only athletes that should be painting their nails, in my opinion, are catchers, and they should be painting their nails white so the pitchers can see the calls. But now they don't even need to do that with the pitch comm. So I don't know. I saw a TikTok of him saying that he first saw Jordan Clarkson painting his nails, so he decided to do it. And then he said, you know, he played good after he got the manicure and whatever. But now he like paints his nails, and I think he's got a sponsorship deal with some like fingernail polish type company like that. It's just too girly for me. I'm sorry. I'm not a fan of it. And I, you know, it is what it is. I was rooting against them, and I'm the Duke guy. I'm the Duke fan, and I was rooting against them in favor of NC State, which is probably sacrilege. You know, if you're a Duke guy, to be rooting for an in-state rival like NC State, but I'm not a true, you know, North Carolinian or anything like that. I just have, you know, grown fond of Duke over the years, and root for them over North Carolina for sure, in this household anyway, because my dad and brother are North Carolina guys. But anyway, so you know, North Carolina State's on this run now in the Final Four. And you might ask yourself, like, how the hell did I pick them to make it to the Elite Eight? Well, I picked them because they won the ACC tournament and they went through the ringer. That was a gauntlet of teams to beat. You know, Virginia, for all it's worth, you know, how bad they were in this tournament, probably shouldn't have made it. That's still a good team. And it was O'Connell that hit that that buzzer beater at the end of regulation, banked it in to send that game to the to overtime. That was the semifinal of the ACC tournament. If NC State loses that game, they finish 19-14, which would not have been good enough, excuse me, to make the tournament. Everybody agreed that would not have been good enough. Everybody knows they needed to win out, win the ACC tournament to get in. Kevin Keats was on the hot seat. Well, they hit that buzzer beater, send it to overtime, and the Wolfpack won that game in overtime. The next game, they took on North Carolina in the ACC championship game, and they beat North Carolina. They got in. They won, what, like 5 games in 5 days? They get in. They dismantle the 6th seed at the time that they played, which was Texas Tech, I believe. They beat up on them, and then the rest is history. They just kept winning and winning. So I had them in the Elite Eight, did not have them this far in the Final Four, and they've just been a joy to watch. DJ Burns, he started out at Tennessee as a freshman. He was a lot skinnier than he is now, but then he went to Winthrop for a couple of years, was player of the year in that conference before coming over to NC State, and he's just been, you know, unbelievable for them this year. And, you know, they've put a really great core of guys together between, you know, O'Connell, the former lacrosse player at Stanford, and Horn, and just a bunch of these guys that have been complementing each other really well. And I give them a puncher's chance for sure against Purdue. I think this is the greatest matchup that we've ever seen. You know, I'm being facetious, but I'm also being kind of serious. The DJ Burns versus Zach Edey matchup is the matchup that we all needed, that we all need, that we really didn't know existed a couple of weeks ago. Like, nobody knew who DJ Burns was a month ago, 2 months ago, a couple of weeks ago even. But now he's on the map. He's getting he's gained a lot of attention from football teams in the NFL. GMs, assistant GMs have actually said that they'd love to see this guy as like an offensive tackle. They'd love to give him an opportunity. But according to DJ Burns himself, he wants nothing to do with the NFL, and he's, you know, focusing on this tournament and on his basketball career as of now. But it doesn't seem like he has much of a future in the NBA. So if I were him, I would try to put on some sort of pro day at NC State and show off my, you know, footwork, and maybe a team takes a flyer on me as an undrafted free agent, and maybe I can get in there, because football players, you know, especially at the tight end position, that come from basketball, you know, the Jimmy Grahams, the Antonio Gateses, really good track record basketball players transitioning to football for sure. So, you know, again, I can't wait for tomorrow night's matchup between Zach Edey and DJ Burns Jr. I said it, you know, Burns is 275. He's about 6'9". Zach Edey's listed at 7'4 and 300 pounds. And he just dropped 40 in their win over Tennessee in the Elite Eight. So it's going to be a fun game, but I definitely, definitely give NC State a puncher's chance for sure. And fun fact about DJ Burns, because he's really the most, you know, the coolest, funnest, if you will, not that that's really a word, but story of this tournament, and everybody, you know, he's always got a smile on his face. He just looks like a cool cat, you know, and he comes from the same area, I believe, as like Zion Williamson too, which is kind of cool. But he was on PMT, and the boys were talking to him, and it's actually quite hilarious. But DJ Burns owns a couple of vending machines that he has on, you know, like a little side business, and which is just so DJ Burns. Take a listen.
Question for you, DJ, and it's something I'm actually weirdly interested in. You sell vending machines?
Yeah, I have a few. I don't sell them. I just own a few. I have two of myself.
That's incredible. So how did you get into that?
That was just, you know, there's a guy who played at Auburn named Josh Dollard. He's from the Charlotte area, and we used to train with this trainer named Gabe Blair, and he, phenomenal guys. And I was just talking to him, you know, about some things at Winthrop, and we were just talking about what are ways to make money outside of basketball so you're not like one dimensional as a person. And that was one of the things he showed me, and I took after it.
I mean, I love that. That's awesome. So you have two active right now, and it just makes money for you?
Yeah, and I've showed a few friends how to do it as well, and they take it a little more serious than I do now.
What's in your vending machines, though? That's very important, because, like, I hope it's not.
I'm gonna be honest. I can't eat what's in my vending machine.
Okay, all right, that's a good thing. Okay, all right.
Yeah, don't get high on your own supply.
Yeah, but it sells well for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it's just all junk food that's in those vending machines. And, you know, again, DJ Burns, big dude, so I'm sure he's on more of a strict diet to try to, you know, maintain that weight, especially in his playing days. So, but yeah, that's just cool in the age of like NIL and different things too. It's kind of cool to hear something like, oh man, because I've actually seen like TikTok videos and stuff about like owning vending machines, and like it is kind of lucrative, or it can be. The placement's kind of tough though to get those like into malls or into different like venues, but it's still pretty cool to hear something like that. But it's something I wanted to play because it sounds like it just fits him to a T. So yeah, again, that's pretty neat and pretty cool. All right, so again, they're playing Purdue. That game is, I forget the time. I'll tell you the time later on in the show at the end, what time that game is on tomorrow night. But yeah, that's going to be a clash of the Titans between Zach Edey, again, coming off a 40 burger and with six to go along with 16 rebounds against Tennessee. So I'm really interested in that game. Both of these games should be pretty good. The other game between Alabama and UConn, I don't know necessarily what to make of that, the one versus the four. UConn, this is their tournament to lose. They have now won 10 straight March Madness tournament games by double digits, setting a new record. I think they've covered the spread in like 10 straight as well. Their Elite Eight game against Illinois, I was somewhat worried going into this game, and then watching it unfold in the first half, they were kind of dominating, but then, you know, Illinois came back. They went to the half tied at 23, and then they opened it up in the second half, went on a 30-0 run from the end of the first half to some point in that second half, 30-0 run, and the game was over in the blink of an eye. They went on to cruise. They cruised past Illinois, winning that game by 25. This was the number two offense in America, was Illinois, and they looked anything but. It's just unbelievable what they've been able to do. Sophomore Klingon, I think he has much bigger upside. I think he's better, more polished right now than Zach Edey. Zach Edey gets all the love, but Zach Edey's 7'4", and Klingon is, what, maybe 7? I don't even know if he's 7 feet. He might be like 6'11", or 7'1", maybe. But he comes from, you know, right there in the heart of Connecticut. He's a born and bred guy right from, you know, the Connecticut area. And he's just been a marvel for them. He's been like basically their best player. And the addition of Cam Spencer, you know, the transfer from Rutgers, from my school, has been great for them. He's been one of their best players, most consistent players this year. They're easily dominating teams. They've now won each of this year's tournament games by, they won, I think, what did they play? Stetson in the first round, making their first appearance. They won that game by 39. The Northwestern game, they didn't shoot the ball well from three at all, and they easily won by 17. And it turns out that was the closest of them all. Then they won by 30 in the Sweet 16. And then, of course, they beat Illinois by 25 in the Elite Eight. And again, I don't even think they're hitting on all cylinders. It's unbelievable. So, you know, again, this is like UConn's tournament this year. They're likely going to go back to back, which is not something to scoff at. This is something that has not been done very often. We know Florida did it in, what, 05, 06. You know, it's unbelievable what Danny Hurley has done. And it's actually funny because Danny Hurley's going up against Nate Oates of Alabama. And at one point, both of these guys were high school teachers and coaching in high school. And then, of course, like Nate Oates, he ended up going to Buffalo, and then he blew up at Buffalo. I think he was an assistant there, and then he eventually took over at Buffalo. I want to say, wasn't Buffalo where Bobby Hurley was coaching before he left to go to Arizona State? I want to say that's what happened. And then that's when Nate Oates took over there. He had a couple of good years. I think they had like a little run in the NCAA tournament, maybe beat somebody or got to a Sweet 16, and then, you know, put him on the map and everyone wanted him. He ends up going to Alabama. And last year they were, what, a one or a two seed, and they were supposed to make a nice run. That's when they had Brandon Miller, all the controversy with that shooting, if you remember. And they were supposed to make a deep run in this thing, and they got bounced in maybe the round of 32, second round, something like that. And then, of course, fast forward to this year as the four seed, not many people had them. And then this is the year they make the run. Kind of similar thing happened to Gonzaga, although not, they didn't make it as far, but oh, that's right. Was Gonzaga the team? Purdue might have beat Gonzaga. Yeah, but that was another team I didn't have getting very far too, and they kind of made a little push. And they were a five seed, having a little bit of an off year this year. But yeah, I don't think it's going to matter. I think UConn will roll in that one again. The actual spread in that game, it's double digits. I know that. Yeah, 11.5. I would probably take that. You got to figure this streak is going to come to an end at some point, but you got to ride it while it's hot. It's like what when you're playing, you know, blackjack and it hits a number like six times in a row, or it hits red or black. Say it hits red like eight times in a row. Are you going to be that guy that's like, nope, I'm going to bet black this time, and then red comes up again? Or are you going to be the guy that jumps on the train and starts hammering, you know, red because it keeps coming up? So that's a decision you got to make. I would roll with it while it's hot, because I don't see them losing this tournament really at all. So yeah, I personally, what I would like to see is a UConn versus NC State final, with UConn taking the crown, just because, you know, I picked them. I'd love to see NC State win this thing. They'd probably go down in history. It would be the biggest Cinderella of all time. I don't believe a double-digit seed has won. I know George Mason, they were an 11 or a 12 seed that year when they made that run, beating UConn to get to the Final Four. I can't quite remember if they were a 12. Were they an 11, 12? That was 2006, so we're going way back now. But let's see. Yeah, they were an 11 seed. So my initial gut reaction told me that they were an 11 seed. So yeah, I just looked it up. That's correct. They were an 11 seed. So, but they didn't win it at, you know, at all. So, you know, NC State, they've got the opportunity. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say this is some sort of David and Goliath situation. I don't think the Big Ten is that good. I'm actually surprised Purdue has made it this far. This is really their longest run. They're the best they've done, you know, in a long time that I can remember of. So I'd love to see NC State with the, I mean, realistically, would I care if NC State won this whole thing? Absolutely not. I think that would be legendary to upset UConn. That would just be unbelievable. But I think it's going to be UConn versus Purdue in the finals, with UConn taking the crown. And I wouldn't mind that necessarily. I'd love to see Klingon go up against Zach Edey, because I do think he's better, as I said earlier. So, you know, I welcome that, and I hope it does happen. Okay, let's switch things up, talk a little golf, because it wasn't just all March Madness over the weekend. We had some golf. So on the men's side of things, it was Steven Yeager holding off Scottie Scheffler, who very uncharacteristically missed what was an easy putt. It might have been like 6, 7, 8 feet, something like that. I'm not really good at judging these things that well, but it was, you know, somewhere, it was under 10 feet. It was an easy putt by any stretch, and he just missed it. It would have sent it to a playoff, and then Scottie probably wins his third in a row at the Houston Open. But instead, it's this guy, Steven Yeager, the 34-year-old, you know, veteran. He's from Germany. It's his first PGA Tour victory, and this is a weird one, although maybe it's not that weird, but he is now the fifth first-time winner this year, and it's only, you know, the beginning of April. And what's crazy is I think that just shows you the amount of parity that's taking place in the PGA Tour, and whether it's because, you know, a lot of the better players, not a lot of them, but a good number of the great players are, you know, still on the LIV Tour and not participating in a lot of these, you know, random tournaments that don't mean a whole lot. So that could have a lot to do with it as well. But yeah, congrats to the 34-year-old German on his win. On the women's side, excuse me, on the women's side, Nelly Korda was able to do exactly what Scotty couldn't. She won three straight. That's right. The 25-year-old world number one made LPGA history at the inaugural Ford Championship on Sunday in Gilbert, Arizona. Actually, I saw some of the footage. Like, the weather was not typical Arizona type weather. It was like windy, rainy. It was dreadful. But she came back from two strokes down. I think she had like the second best score on the day on Sunday. And it was her third consecutive win on tour this season. She's really, really come alive since she turned pro. And, you know, her and her sister have both won on the PGA Tour. And I think they're one of three sisters to ever win on the LPGA Tour. So pretty cool stuff there. Some other cool stuff. Let's switch things back to football for a second, because although it might not be NFL season right now, we do have some football going on in the UFL this spring. And it was YouTuber Destroying. If you know who I'm talking about, yes, I'm talking about Donald De La Haye. He was the kid that was the kicker at UCF a number of years ago. What are we talking, like 5-6 years ago? And this was before NIL and all that stuff. He started like to gain some traction with his YouTube channel, and he would do like some trick shot, you know, kicking. And he was a black kid as a place kicker at a Division I college. So that was also a very big deal, because, you know, I can't name anybody that I saw in college football this year, forgive me if I'm wrong, that was black and that was a kicker on a football team. It's very rare. We don't really see that in the NFL. We've seen a couple of punters over the years that were you know, black. So this was a really big deal. And he's just a likable, bubbly personality type guy. I would watch some of his videos. He had a monstrous leg, and it was unfortunate because he was basically given the ultimatum: stop the YouTube channel because you can't make money off of it, or shut the YouTube channel down and play football. He had two options: quit football and do the YouTube thing full time. He started to gain traction, had about 2 million followers at the time. Shut that down, which was something he started to really enjoy and love, and continue to play football, or throw the football thing away and go to the social media stuff full time. And I guess maybe he just didn't see a future for himself in the NFL, or he was like, you know what, you're not going to put me in a box. You're not going to, you know, put a muzzle on me and tell me I can't do something. So he quit football to do the YouTube thing full time. And he's super athletic. He has like 5.8 million followers, one of the most followed sports YouTubers on the planet. And I've seen a lot of his videos. Like, he'll go and he'll play like one-on-one cornerback and switch off as corner and receiver, or just maybe play corner up against some of like the top high school players and different things of that nature in like the Florida area. But he goes all over. He's super famous now. So he actually is playing in the UFL right now. And this is not just some like gimmick marketing type, like, you know, Tim Tebow type of thing with the Mets or anything like that. Because the Toronto Argonauts, they tried him out. Excuse me, not the Toronto Argonauts. He hasn't. He signed with the Toronto Argonauts in like 2019 of the CFL, but he never appeared in a regular season game for the team. And again, he's 27, so he hasn't kicked in a game in college or any professional league in at least 5-6 years. Okay. And so he tried out with the San Antonio Brahmas, and he actually beat out former NFL kicker Matt Amendola, who we've all heard of. I mean, he's been in the league in the last, you know, couple of years bouncing around and stuff. So that's a big deal that he beat him out. And you know, that's pretty cool. So maybe his NFL dreams are alive, because we've seen kickers, you know, the Cowboys kicker came from, you know, basically this league as well, last year. And so, you know, these GMs and these NFL teams are watching. And he attempted a 64-yard field goal, I saw, because the game's start debuted like a week and a half ago or last week or whatever. And there was a timeout called, but he had enough leg on the 64-yarder. He pushed it wide right, but they called a timeout. And then when they went out there to re-kick it, they actually did a trick play, and it was a fake field goal, and they actually threw it, and they got a touchdown out of it, like a 40-yard bomb downfield, scored a touchdown. So I don't think he actually, you know, had a field goal attempt in that game, but it's still an unbelievably cool story. And if this was today's day and age, if he was born 5 years later, his YouTube channel, that whole thing would just be another drop in the hat. Like, it would be Jared McCain. It would be totally normal. He'd be able to monetize off of that YouTube channel, and he'd be able to kick. So, you know, it is what it is. But yeah, cool story. Okay, so we've seen the disparity in women's versus men's sports before, so it never ceases to amaze me when the women get the short end of the stick. And I see it. I coach women's sports now too, women's softball. So obviously they're not, you know, underfunded, especially at the higher levels. You know, they don't get as many viewership or fans, although don't tell the, you know, college basketball world that, as Iowa LSU the other night had the most viewership, the highest viewership numbers like ever, which I'll get into in a little bit. But what I'm getting at is, do you remember 3 years ago, just after COVID, when they brought the NCAA tournament back, March Madness back for the first time after they canceled it in 2020? All over social media, it went viral. Posts went viral from players showing these stark differences between the weight room that the women had compared to the men's weight room at, I don't know, one of the host sites at somewhere in Texas, I think it was. Well, once again, shocker, there was a screw up yet again. This time it was in Portland at the Elite Eight. Ahead of Sunday's game, this was at the Moda Center in Portland. They played like six games here prior to this, or at least four, you know, Sweet 16 games. And because they played Friday and Saturday. NC State and Texas, both coaches noticed that the three-point line on the one side of the court was way off from the other side. They actually took a tape measure out and they determined that it was 9 inches shorter. So NC State is the 3 seed. Texas is the 1 seed. This was Sunday ahead of their Elite Eight matchup. The NC State coach apparently wanted to just play the game because they said it would be a delay. It would take an hour. They might not be able to broadcast the game or something to that effect on ABC. There was some issue with the broadcasting at that point. And so the NC State coach wanted to continue playing. That being Wes Moore. This all according to Vic Schaefer. Now, Vic Schaefer said he just went along with it because he didn't want to be that guy, you know, the guy that said no, made a big deal out of it. And Texas ends up losing as the number 1 seed. So I wonder if he regrets that decision now. Looking back, of course, hindsight's 20/20. You know, they could have sat for an hour and his team could have been even worse because they were just, you know, dilly-dallying, not ready to go, and sitting for an hour after warming up or whatever it could be a problem too. But Texas was just 1 for 6 from three in this game. Makes you wonder. I don't know if they were 1 for 6 from that side or what, but NC State went 9 for 18. Now, did they only attempt 6 threes? I don't study Texas women's college basketball, so I don't know if they're a typically a high volume 3-point shooting team or not. But clearly, NC State was throwing them up, and they were making them 9 of 18. That's 50%. That is a high percentage to shoot from three. You're gonna win against anybody if you shoot 50% from three. And so you wonder if that had a big impact on that, and whether you know, Schaefer regrets that decision to not delay the game and get the line fixed or not. They've since gone ahead and fixed it, but I don't think it matters because I don't think they're playing the Final Four there. But just, I don't know how nobody sees that over those first couple of days. They played all these games there. And what's crazy is 4 Sweet 16 games, like I said, on Friday and Saturday on the same court, Nobody noticed it. Stanford, the number one seed, they got bounced. They shot 2 for 13 from three, or Stanford might have been the number two seed. They were 2 for 13 from three in the second half. No, Stanford, I think, was a one seed. Anyway, they were 2 for 13 in the second half alone. Again, I don't know if that's not all from that side, but it plays a factor. That was against NC State, who was just 1 for 6 from deep in the first half of that game. So just terrible shooting numbers all around. And then in Gonzaga's loss, they were affected the biggest. In Gonzaga's loss to Texas, they shot just 18% from three. That was a bit of a blowout, but still just 18%. And of course, you got to wonder if it had anything to do with the three-point line being off on one side. Yeah, it had to have. I mean, that's ridiculous that this was an issue. And it wasn't the first time in this year's tournament. Once again, this only happens on the women's side. I could only see this happening in women's sports. It's just bizarre. And coincidentally enough, this is not the first time involving NC State. Obviously, they were part of this three-point line debacle. There was an oversight that led to questions being asked of the NCAA. The organization had to replace one of the referees from the Wolfpack's 64-45 win over Chattanooga because the referee had obtained a master's degree from Chattanooga. And obviously, you know, conflict of interest there, right? You know, he went to Chattanooga. He might be more inclined to give more favorable calls to Chattanooga, just not on purpose, but innately, just by default, because he has, you know, a more positive outlook on that school, being that he went there, or she went there. Just incredible. Just incredible stuff. This would never happen on the men's side, and it's just ridiculous. The NCAA continues to baffle my minds and just get this thing wrong. It really is unbelievable. But again, they got something right, because the viewership numbers are up across the board, and I expect a high volume of viewers tonight for those two Final Four games. And I'm actually glad we don't have games tomorrow, because I can stay up late and watch these games. So I'm excited, because that the better game between Iowa and UConn is not going to tip off till like 9:30, 9:40. So it's going to be a bit of a rough one. Okay. From the bad to the good. Let's talk about the Iowa LSU game, the Elite Eight game, which obviously was a rematch of last year's championship game, in which LSU got the better of Caitlin Clark in Iowa. This was the whole game where, you know, Angel Reese became the villain, if you will. She was, you know, waving her hand in front of her face, pointing at her ring finger, just a lot of like unsportsmanlike type stuff. You know, she was passionate in the moment, just stuff that if I was the coach, I would have yelled at her and told her to dial it down and act respectful, because, oh, she was a mouse, quiet as a mouse after the game, you know, when they lost. And, you know, she could dish it out when they win, but she can't handle it when they lose. So a lot of people took exception to her attitude, you know, doing it one way when you win, but then when you lose, you're quiet, right? So, you know, but again, this was a great game. Obviously, two different teams than last year. Iowa had that same core group of players. LSU had a couple, but not those same girls from last year. Of course, transfer Haley Van Lith from Louisville this year. You know, so anyway. Caitlin Clark was unstoppable in this game. She went off for 41. She made 9 3-pointers, tying an NCAA tournament record in their 94-87 victory. Angel Reese was pretty good in this game. By her standards, I'm sure she would have agreed that she didn't do enough offensively, missed a lot of, you know, buckets that she should have had, but she had 20 rebounds. I think 10 were offensive boards, but she only put up 17 points, and then she fouled out in the fourth quarter. And I was very surprised. I don't know why they're playing the regional in Albany, New York, of all places, but the Iowa fans showed up in spades, and there was really no LSU fans to be had. I think a lot of this, too, was not just straight up Iowa fans from the state of Iowa. I think, you know, Dave Portnoy was there supporting Iowa, and he's a Michigan guy, but he is another one, takes exception to LSU. They're painted as the villain, and everyone wanted to see Iowa beat them this year after what took place last year. And there was, you know, great game on the court, but there was also some controversy off the court as well. Well, no, it was on the court, but it was before the game. So there was controversy surrounding the fact that LSU did not come out of the locker room for the national anthem while the Iowa players were standing, arms interlocked, and they were proud and they looked excited and they stood for that national anthem, right? As you should. LSU was nowhere to be found. No players, no coaches anywhere to be found, which is, you know, to many, that's a downright travesty. You know, it's what we've been talking about in sports for the better part of, you know, the last bunch of years since Colin Kaepernick started to kneel and the whole controversy behind that. Well, LSU Governor Jeff Landry, never heard of the guy before, right? But this is the governor of Louisiana calling out Louisiana State and what they did. Just take a listen to this. This was on Fox News, I believe. I found this on Twitter. This is some good stuff.
Governor of Louisiana, Jeff Landry, who is now calling for consequences for that. Governor, welcome to you. And we know that you're a huge LSU fan. You've got the shirt on. So why are you calling out the players?
Yeah, and Well, look, I'm not calling out the players or Coach Mulkey. I support Coach Mulkey. My statement said that. I mean, look, I think this is a bigger question. This is a bigger problem for collegiate sports nationally and in Louisiana. I just sent out a letter to each one of our college boards telling them that those college boards should put in place a policy that respects the national anthem. The national anthem is as much a part of American sports as is the actual game that's being played. And the fact that there is not a policy that says, listen, these players are going to be out there and respect the flag and respect those that go out there and protect us is really disrespectful in and of itself. So it's unfortunate that LSU was not there at that particular time. Iowa was on the field. That highlighted the particular problem. And what we're going to do is work in Louisiana and say, listen, college athletes need to understand that in order to be truly united, in order to truly have civics and civility, we all need to be united under one flag and respect that anthem.
Yeah, well said. I do agree with that. Now, I do want to make clear, I'll play a little clip, Kim Mulkey responding to it. Not a great answer by her, by the way, but she does say in this clip that, and I'm going to make clear of this now, this was not some sort of protest on LSU's part, like a kneeling for the anthem type of thing. This had nothing to do with that. So I'll play that clip of Kim Mulkey, and then I'll kind of go further into detail on it.
Honestly, I don't even know when the anthem was played. We kind of have a routine where we are on the floor and then they come off at the 12-minute mark.
That's when
the anthem. We just, I don't know, and we come in and we do our pregame stuff. I'm sorry. I that's nothing intentionally done.
That's a scary answer to say that you don't even know when the anthem was done. I mean, there's fans that pay good money to go to this game. They could be in the bathroom. They could be at the, getting food at concessions. And it don't matter where you are. When that national anthem starts, everybody in the building stops, turns around, finds the flag. You know, if you can't see the flag because you're at concessions or whatever, you'll look at the TV, the monitors that are up there. And that's, you know, and you stand still, everybody, you know, hand over your heart, whatever. And you take your hat off and you respect the anthem and your players are in the locker room and you're, you know, singing and dancing and playing music and whatever to get in your right headspace and all that stuff. That's all well and good, but that's not acceptable to do that during the national anthem. And the way she just kind of like threw it out there, like so not nonchalantly, like we don't even know when the anthem was. That's a problem. And that's not a good look for LSU. And I'm right here with Jeff Landry. I saw he did tweet something out. This was his more civilized response or answer on Fox News. And maybe he had a day or so to think this over and come up with a better solution. But he tweeted out that they should take their scholarships if they don't come out for the national anthem. And this is about his own home state team. So, yeah, crazy stuff. I just not a good look for LSU all the way around. You know, they're the villains of college basketball, and they're being vilified for sure, having lost that game. Oh, and speaking of, now that the dust has settled, Haley Van Lith, her LSU career, which lasted 1 year, is going to be known for her trying to guard Caitlin Clark in the last play that we remembered that went viral as a meme, was her kind of just like shaking her head and putting her palms up and shrugging her shoulders, like, you know, after Caitlin Clark just drains a Steph Curry level three, and she just goes like shrugs and puts her hands up like, what else can I do, right? And so she had a tough night. I don't think she put up a whole lot of points, maybe like 9 points or something. She struggled to shoot the ball. And that's that. Caitlin Clark, you know, beat her down so good that she's like, peace out. And she's leaving. Although I will say this, I'm obviously joking. It's not about what Caitlin Clark did to her. I think Haley Van Lith is like possibly the first player on the women's side, although the really good player from Virginia Tech just entered the transfer portal, but I suspect that's more to do with the fact that her coach just left to take the, I think, Kentucky job, so she might wind up there. But Haley Van Lith might be the first player in this new, you know, transfer portal day, in these transfer portal days, that might truly be like title chasing. And so, you know, she played at Louisville. Now she went to LSU. That gave her a good shot to win a title. And now she's going to probably wind up at another really good school. I could see her going to maybe a UConn or something like that, you know, somewhere else where she's got a chance to win another title. So am I going to fault her for it? Not necessarily, because this is just what these players do. It's not my cup of tea. But again, you got to play to the narrative, and you got to do what's best for you. And in this day and age, it's kind of like, you know, if you don't adapt and do what everyone else is doing, you might fall behind, and then you might be that player that's stuck at a school for 4 years that doesn't play, that maybe, you know, doesn't have as good as a career somewhere else if they were to leave and switch. And who's to say, if I was in that position, if I've got NIL offers, if colleges are offering me, hey, come over, come here, we'll give you $1 million from our NIL collective, or come to our school, we'll give you money from our collect. Like, it's just so difficult to pick and choose. And these are 20, 21, 22-year-old kids having to make these lifelong decisions that are best for them, because a lot of these women, especially, to go into the professional, you know, the WNBA, there's not a lot of money to be had there. Like, Caitlin Clark was offered $5 million by Ice Cube to join the Big Three league that he runs. And I said I would have taken it. I would take the money, forego the WNBA. $5 million is insane for a female athlete in that sport in this day and age. So I'll be interested to see where Haley Van Lith finds herself next season. Some final numbers on this game: 12.3 million average viewers with a peak of 16 million.
Oh my God.
For context, ladies and gentlemen, that is higher than any women's college basketball game ever. I had this talk with my dad. I thought it was just like on ESPN or whatever. I didn't realize like this was shattering records of this magnitude. It was also more than every NBA game last season, not including game 5 of the NBA finals, every MLB game last season, and all but 5 college football matchups. Not surprising, because MLB is just doesn't get a lot of viewership of late, but talk about crazy. So that shattered numbers. I expect tonight's game to also, I don't know if it'll reach that peak, but I think we could see like 10 million, definitely. Okay, the baseball season is fully underway, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my Yankees, sweeping their rival Houston Astros. I don't even consider like the Red Sox a rival now, because the two teams haven't been good for a bit, but the Astros are our big rival, those damn cheaters. And we swept them in 4 games. Juan Soto was great. It's been up and down since then. You know, I knew they were going to come back down to earth. We won, 2 out of 3 in Arizona, and then we just lost today 3-0 in our home debut. You know, home opener, middle of an earthquake happening this morning. They're taking batting practice, didn't seem to faze them. And then we go out there, Stroman gives us 6 strong, 6 Ks against his former team, and we lay a goose egg and lose 3-0 in that 9th inning debacle, giving up 2 runs, walks, you know, wild pitches. and, you know, went down in order in the ninth inning against another former Yankee in Chad Green. So that was not pretty at all today. And the Yankees now sit at like 6-2 atop the AL East. So long ways to go. But again, Jonathan Loaisiga, typical of the Yankees. He just pitched the other day, and now his season is probably over, and he's going to the IL with some sort of elbow issue, and which I expect will knock him out for the whole season. Kind of like Julius Randle, you know, they pretend that he's going to come back, put him on, you know, the couple month IL, you know, try to rehab him. And then when it's time to come back right at the end of the season, oh, by the way, sorry, you know, he's out for the year. He needs surgery. And that's exactly what's going to happen with Gerrit Cole. Mark my words. And that's what's happening right now with Loaisiga. I just can feel it. I know exactly what's happening. You know, enough of the Yankees. Also, by the way, the Pittsburgh Pirates are like 6-1. I don't know if they played. Oh, yeah, they're playing. They were playing in the snow before. Some crazy snowstorm in Pittsburgh. You also have the Tigers, surprisingly, 5-1. You had the Mets start 0-4. And you had the Mets played a doubleheader, early afternoon doubleheader, because of some rainouts. And they went 13 innings from game one, went to extra innings. They lost to the Tigers. And then game two, they didn't get a hit from the fifth inning from the first game all the way through a few innings, at least in the second game, like the seventh inning maybe of the second game. And then I know Pete Alonso tied it in the ninth, and they finally got their first win of the season. They were at least 0-4, 0-5. So I have Mets fans, friends that are Mets fans, that are just, the season's over already to them. They're just so disgusted. You know, Frank the Tank, all over social media. He's been losing his mind over the grounds crew in the seventh inning, always dancing and stuff when the Mets are sucking. So it's been a tough go of things for Mets fans of late. But yeah, that's kind of the gist of what's been going on around baseball. The 7-2 Dodgers, which I'll talk about them and some more controversy surrounding Shohei Ohtani, as if things can't get any worse. But the reason I wanted to talk a little baseball is because those Astros that I said my Yankees swept, they were 0-4 and looking for their first victory, and they got it by way of Ronel Blanco making just his eighth MLB start ever.
Ground ball. Dubon throws the first. No-hitter! Ronel Blanco in his eighth career start. The 30-year-old makes magic on April Fool's Day.
Congratulations to Ronel Blanco. Nobody saw this coming except Ronel. He felt it coming out of the bullpen, I would imagine. Executed beautifully, worked extremely well with Yiner Diaz. But after a four-game skid, Ronel Blanco is the one that stops it in grand fashion with a no-no.
Yeah, go figure. It feels like that's just something totally Astro-like that would happen after starting the season 0-4. They just get a no-hitter from some guy who barely made the team out of spring training. And actually, he was in spring training, and the day his wife gave birth to their child was the day he found out, I believe, he made the team. So kind of a cool story. He's a guy that never pitched more than six innings or threw more than 100 pitches in a game before, and he went a complete game, 105 pitches. He threw his changeup more than he's ever thrown it before, and it was a 10-0 blowout of the Blue Jays, which, speaking of the Blue Jays, 2 days after they got no hit, they got one hit by those Astros, and then, of course, they beat the Yankees today, which just proves to me that the Yankees are not legit or for real, at least right now. So, yeah. Okay, let's get back to football for a second. I haven't talked a lot of NFL or anything, but this is some sad news. Former Colts defensive back Vontae Davis was found dead in his Florida home on Sunday. Davis played parts of 10 seasons in the NFL, mostly with the Colts, played with the Bills a little bit, and with the Dolphins. I think he started his career with the Dolphins before being traded to the Colts, where he had a pretty good career, made two Pro Bowls. He is most famous for, this happened, it feels like just yesterday that this happened, but it was 2018. He was on the Bills week two. He retired at halftime of the game. He was like, peace out. Or it was against the Bills, maybe, and he was on the Colts, whatever it was. But he just peaced out in the middle of the game, and that was like, whoa, this team has major problems. And so we won't know more, obviously, until like autopsy or whatever can be performed. But he is the younger brother of Vernon Davis, you know, one of the all-time great tight ends. And he said that his younger brother collapsed at his home while getting out of his sauna. And he said that, well, his ex-wife, Vontae Davis's ex-wife, believes he has CTE. Vernon Davis said, well, obviously, we won't know until they, you know, check out his brain post-mortem, because that's not something you can detect when they're alive. And whether he did or not, it doesn't matter. This wasn't a suicide. This wasn't a drug overdose. We don't believe nothing like that. This could have just been, you know, just a medical event. Something of the like, something like that, that just happened out of nowhere. Again, you play this is a violent, violent sport, and you take a lot of hits. You play a lot of football, a lot of, you know, crashing and banging from the time you're, you know, a toddler all the way up to high school, college, NFL, and you're hitting guys hard. And now these safeties and corners, you know, they come up in the box and you know, they're hard hitting. And so who knows what could have happened. He could have had a heart condition, could have had it, whatever. We just won't know more until they check out his brain and do tests and do an autopsy, if that's even going to take place or whatever. But it's just a sad, sad story. So RIP to you know, his family and everybody, you know, that was his, you know, teammates, coaches, et cetera, et cetera. I always hate hearing when players that young, I think he was in his 30s, die. So it's just, it's rough. Carson Wentz, he has a new home. What did he get signed by, like, the Rams super late last season, right? Well, he is going to have a home, at least in training camp this year. He's been signed to a one-year deal by the Kansas City Chiefs to serve as Patrick Mahomes' backup. I actually think that's a really good spot for him. God forbid Patrick Mahomes has to miss any time. I think Andy Reid will get Carson Wentz up to par and ready to go if they should need him. Okay, Bryce Harper, he entered this wasn't last night. I think this was a couple nights ago. He entered the game 0-11 on the season, which obviously sparked some worry from fans, from myself. He's on my fantasy team, right? Well, he was just fine after this game because he blasted not one, not two, but three home runs in the Phillies' 9-4 win over the Reds, culminating in a grand slam. Three home runs and just six RBI. So the first two were solo shots. But he is just the fifth player in franchise history to hit three dingers in a game this century. It's his second three home run game, first as a Philly. His last one came with the Nationals, I want to say 9 years ago. So that's pretty wild. And then real quick back to football, trying to keep this in chronological order. But I did not have Stephon Diggs being traded on my Wednesday morning bingo card, but that's exactly what happened. The Bills traded Diggs to the Texans for a second round pick and chose to accept $31 million in dead cap space in order to move him. Things with Diggs soured from the offseason of last year when there was rumors that they might get rid of him. And in the end, he just could not get open that final game against the Chiefs. It was like, what is going on? The Bills see an aging, disgruntled wide receiver and chose to move on. And I think this was actually a good trade by both teams. It just shows that they only got a second-round pick for him, so it shows what his value is. The Texans did actually restructure his deal to where this is a prove-it year for him now. It's a one-year deal. He can, he'll be a free agent after this season with the Texans. But for the Bills, I don't know what they're doing. They're kind of in wide receiver limbo. Got to figure out, you know, what their next move is going to be. I think this is just great to get Diggs out of the AFC East. This makes it that much easier for my Jets. And then it came out earlier today, I saw there was a blow up, which I don't even consider it that, but there was a tiff in the locker room after that Monday night, September 11th, week one loss to the Jets. Remember that overtime game in which Gibson, you know, ran the punt back to start overtime after the Jets got a three and out and the Jets won that game. Apparently in the locker room, Josh Allen cursed at Stephon Diggs and told him basically to relax. It's only one effing game. So Stephon Diggs didn't take too kindly to that, but that's what your quarterback's supposed to do. Be the leader. Tell him to shut up and put him in his place and to stop overreacting after one game, because this team went on an unbelievable run. Okay, they ended up firing their offensive coordinator, but they still went on an unbelievable run. Joe Brady did a great job. I picked them to beat the Chiefs in that game. Stupidly enough, they got blown out of the water. But that second round, you know, divisional game, I thought they had a chance to beat the Chiefs. And, you know, it fell apart there and things quickly soured. That this Bills team, their run is over. That window that they had to win a championship, in my opinion, is officially over. OK, so good luck there. This is the Jets AFC East to win. OK, and I don't even know that the Bills will make the playoffs next year. I'll go as far as to say that I think they're going to be the third best team in this division at this point. Okay, let's get back to Louisiana. I talked about the governor, talked about LSU a little bit. This is an interesting one. Louisiana has become the first state to ban bets on college athletes, to ban prop bets. That's a big difference. This is a step that could lead to sweeping changes across the nation, which is a little scary because a lot of people love to bet on the props. And prop bets are player props. We're talking like, you know, will this player have under or over 20 and a half points, or, you know, points, rebounds, assists, or blah, whatever, double doubles, or you name it. You can bet on all sorts of player props for different players. Now, the problem with this, though, is it leads to horrible, you know, the players are stressing out because the fans are incessant, probably yelling and screaming at them. We've heard of athletes, you know, in pro sports, on the sidelines, like guys with courtside seats or in the first couple rows yelling at a player like, hey, like Paul George, I need you to hit another three. I need one more three, or I need three more points. And they're winning by 30 points. And then Paul George goes out there and he's chucking up threes, you know, to help this dude out randomly. So it leads to, you know, that. It also can lead to the most obvious potential, which is for game fixing by players. We had this guy on the Raptors that's been busted for betting on his own prop bets himself, betting on himself, which is just insane. So it can lead to all sorts of stuff. And especially at the college level, I don't think it's necessarily a great thing to have the prop bets, because obviously college players are not making the millions upon millions that the pros are. So a lot of these, you know, mobsters, if you will, or whoever, can offer some of these kids, you know, whether it's maybe the Ivy League schools or whatever. We saw that what happened at, I think it was the Alabama baseball coach, you know, fixing the one game or giving a tip to a buddy at the sports book and so different things like that. But if you have like some mobster guy or whatever, sounding so old school saying the word mobster, you know, some guy like that gets in a player's ear and offers them, you know, 50 G's to throw this game, or to, you know, go out and score less than this or more than this, whatever. And I'm sure the players must know. I know if I was playing whatever sport, say it's basketball, I would definitely know, be looking and seeing what my line is set for today. Oh, you know, my over under for points is like set at 17 and a half. They only think I'm going to score 17 and a half tonight. Well, I'm going to go show them, you know, stuff like that. So it's just, it's an interesting change. And I definitely think we're going to see more of this throughout the nation, not just in Louisiana. Okay. Remember the guy, Malachi Flynn? Does that name ring a bell? Well, if you're a Knicks fan, it might. Malachi Flynn, I believe he went to Washington State, but he was on the Raptors. They traded him in the RJ Barrett, Emmanuel Quickley deal. He came over with OG. He was on the Knicks for a hot minute before they traded him. I think five games with the Knicks before they traded him to Detroit for Bojan Bogdanovic and Burks, which I haven't heard much of those two guys in months. But anyway, he goes to Detroit. Detroit's the worst team in the NBA, really. And all he does is drop 50 off the bench the other night. 50.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I never heard of such a thing. It was a 121 to 113 loss. It's the most points off the bench by a player in Pistons franchise history. And that history has a lot of winning in it. I mean, that's wild. Wild. One of the craziest, I think that's one of the craziest things I've heard in sports in a long time. Just a guy coming out of nowhere. That's Jeremy Lin-esque. The fact that this guy dropped 50. I don't even think Jeremy Lin ever dropped 50. Just out of absolutely nowhere. Whoa. And here's something interesting that I haven't heard mentioned at all. It doesn't have a whole lot of traction, but I do want to mention it because I think in the next couple of years, this is going to start to gain some serious momentum. So there is a 20-person group or conglomerate or whatever you want to call it, made up of several college presidents, and they are calling themselves College Sports Tomorrow, CST. They have proposed an idea to basically wipe out the NCAA and split college football's highest level into two tiers. So in the proposal, the top 70 programs, which are all members of the five former major conferences, the Power Five conferences, plus your Notre Dame and a new ACC member, SMU, which, by the way, Andy Enfield left USC, within the last week to take the SMU job and help, you know, guide them into the ACC, which they will be in now, as permanent members and encompass all 130 plus FBS universities. The perpetual members would be in seven 10-team divisions, joined by an eighth division of teams that would be promoted from the second tier. While the ACC, this is the important part, the ACC Board of Directors was apparently the only ones to listen to this presentation from College Sports Tomorrow officials. The Big Ten, SEC, and Big 12 all canceled plans for a similar sit-down, and that's why I said it's probably not going anywhere. It's going to be almost impossible to wrap your head around how they would maneuver this, the logistics behind ripping up the current TV deals, figuring out the broadcasting rights for a two-division college football super league. I hear this is kind of something that they're doing in either the Premier League or one of the soccer leagues over in Europe. So we're not really far off from this happening, but they made a good point. It's easy for a college football team that plays once a week to go across country. Like, it's easy for UCLA to come here and play Rutgers, once a week or one time a year. But think about like the softball team or the baseball team that has to go play a series, the Rutgers team that has to go out to USC or UCLA to play a series, and all that school they're going to miss and all that crazy travel. It just doesn't make sense. And so I totally get it. And I kind of like this idea. And I think we are headed in that direction at some point, just no time soon. All right, Shohei Ohtani, there is more controversy surrounding this man than anyone else in sports right now, and it just keeps getting worse. So, What should have been a great moment for the Dodgers, for Ohtani, for everybody involved, soured real quick. So Ohtani hit his first home run as a Dodger on Wednesday, probably a big sigh of relief to get that out of the way. It was a 430-foot blast, and again, there was all sorts of controversy surrounding this because obviously they wanted to get the ball back. That was a special home run ball that they wanted to get to Ohtani, whatever, put it on display somewhere, whatever. And so this woman and her husband, they were a Spanish couple. I forgot the last name, but her husband immediately goes diving for this ball, and a bunch of people did, obviously, and it just wound up in front of her. Like, just squirted out right in front of her, and she picks up the ball, right? So she has this ball. Immediately, security comes. They grab her and the husband, and they start to escort them, to some interrogation room, if you will. And they separate them. And as they're walking them out, she didn't really realize. She sounded a little naive in some interviews I've seen and sounded like she didn't know too much. But they said, this is the first home run he's hit as a Dodger, right? So they get her in this room. They offered her two signed hats from Ohtani. And these were like not even like new era friggin', you know, fitted hats. These look like cheap little, you know, the adjustable ones, not the snapback ones, but like the dad hats in the back. And they offered her two signed hats. Big freaking whoop. Auction houses had this ball going for at least 100K minimum right off the bat. And so she said, well, that's not good enough. I want a little bit more. And the fact they separated her and the husband was just shady. So he couldn't help her out. And she's just a girl, a woman that doesn't probably know any better. So she's like, well, that's not enough. I want more. Then they were like, okay, we'll give you a bat signed by Ohtani and a baseball signed by Ohtani. So she says she felt pressured. She ends up taking the deal, never meets Ohtani, just wanted to meet him, maybe take a picture, whatever. And they were also, they claimed that the Dodgers brass was also threatening her that if she kept the ball, they would not stamp it or mark it as authentic. They would not authenticate this baseball. And if they were not able to authenticate this baseball, then it would be virtually useless. So they were threatening her all over. And this was ridiculous. And then to make matters worse, Ohtani, through his interpreter after the game, says that, I want to get this right. Let me see. Oh, yeah. He says that through his translator, and I quote, I was able to talk to the fan and was able to get it back, being the ball. And they said they never met him. They never spoke to him. So did a security guard, did somebody associated with the team relay a message from Ohtani? I don't know, but you're not being very transparent. And if that's the case, that's not what you said. You said I was able to talk to the fan. That tells me and everybody else reading that, that you met the fan and you talked to them. And that was not the case. And they're trying to say, they're saying now, like, we just want to meet him. We would love a picture with Ohtani, get to meet him, whatever. And none of that happened. And I put blame on all parties. I think she was stupid and naive. I would have called their bluff and said, okay, great. You don't want to authenticate the ball? Well, you're not getting the ball then. And I'll walk. And for the Dodgers to separate her from her husband and to lowball her like that and offer her like four items worth, they said maybe $1,000 a piece when she had a lottery ticket right there that she doesn't even know about. They scammed her so hard, which was not right. And then on Ohtani's part, he did them dirty too. Like after the game, you know, you should have went and met this couple and taking some photos with them. Like, you have such bad press surrounding your name right now with the gambling stuff with your former interpreter, that this would be all good, positive press. You know, you go meet this family, the Dodgers post some pictures online on Instagram, post stuff about it on Twitter, you know, maybe make a TikTok video about it from the Dodgers official account. This couple would be super excited to meet Ohtani. They would post about it, say, oh, everybody was so great. You know, we felt appreciated, blah, blah, whatever. And you know, you make friends out of the deal. So nobody did the right thing here. And it's just, again, just poor planning. And it makes Ohtani look like a bad guy again. Makes him look like another, like a lot, like he's lying yet again. So, you know, it's just some shady stuff that's going on with that Dodgers team. And unfortunately, we're going to see a lot of them because they're, you know, 7-2 and they keep winning and they have one of the best teams in baseball. All right. One of the worst teams in baseball, from one of the best to one of the worst. Let's talk the A's. So we all know the A's are they've had controversy with the city of Oakland. They're basically the last holdout, the last professional team that's still in Oakland, and they're moving to Vegas to join the Raiders, right? So in the meantime, that stadium won't be open for at least 3 years. The A's are moving to Sacramento beginning next season for at least 3 years before they permanently relocate to Vegas in roughly 2028. The A's will share a stadium with AAA Sacramento River Cats, but they will not, this is very important, will not include Sacramento or Oakland anywhere on team branding. So much like the Washington, you know, football team, they're going to be known as just the Athletics or the A's. There is no city attached to this name. And what's great is you got to listen to team owner John Fisher just salivating over the most intimate ballpark in the MLB. That's what he calls it, the most intimate ballpark in Major League Baseball.
We're excited to be here for the next 3 years playing in this beautiful ballpark. But also being able to watch some of the greatest players in baseball, whether they be Athletics players or Aaron Judge and others, launch home runs out of this very intimate the most intimate ballpark in all of Major League Baseball for the next 3 years.
Yeah, it's the most intimate ballpark in Major League Baseball because it only seats 10,000. 10,000 fans, that's it. But again, that's okay because the A's, I looked this up, the A's average 10,275 people per game last season. Just awful. And I will never forget this. My friend went out to Oakland last season and he went to an early afternoon game and kid you not, he said there was about 2,300 people in attendance at this game. It's just unbelievable. So they're going to look, you know, real crowded. And apparently this guy, this A's owner, John Fisher, is a big, big fan of Aaron Judge. Okay, I hinted on this earlier, but Julius Randle, he will undergo season-ending shoulder surgery and will be reevaluated in 5 months, which could put his status for next season's opener in doubt because they botched this whole thing. He should have just got surgery from the start, but whatever. His absence, along with a less than full OG Anunoby, it means, Knicks fans, that you just need to shut up. You can pump the brakes on, you know, any thoughts of a deep run in the playoffs. Personally, as an, you know, I'm not even talking as like a Nets fan or some person, you know, that just hates on the Knicks. I personally don't believe the Knicks will get out of the first round. Now, I'm not ready to commit to that 100%. I got to see where the seeding falls. They could just as easily be in the play-in. They had a nice come-from-behind win against Sacramento last night. They could just as easily be in the play-in as they could get the 4, 5, 6, 7. I mean, well, 7 would be in the play-in, I believe. But yeah, they could finish like anywhere from 2 to 6 to play-in. So until I know exactly who they're playing, I think they could beat the Magic in the first round. I think they could beat Indiana. They're not beating Milwaukee. They're not going to beat Boston. God forbid they have to get Boston in the first round. That would mean they're the 8th seed. That would mean they collapsed down the stretch. I think there's only, what, like 5 games left on the season, something like that. But yeah, sayonara, Knicks. Your season's over. On to next year. None of the trades worked out. None of anything worked out for you this year, except, you know, your point guard is pretty darn good in Jalen Brunson. And you got really great production, probably the best years from that you'll ever see from, you know, Josh Hart, number one. He almost had a triple-double again last night. And then, of course, Dante DiVincenzo has had a breakout season, the best of his career by a long shot. But, yeah, pump the brakes. The season's pretty much over. Chiefs wide receiver Rashee Rice was involved in a multi-car crash over the weekend. This is what not to do as a professional athlete, ladies and gentlemen. He is a Super Bowl champ, you know, first-year player, second-round pick out of SMU, became really Patrick Mahomes' top target this year. You know, he's feeling himself. He's got that bling bling. He's making money. He's a professional, okay? He is living large, balling, right? And then he goes and does something stupid like this. And it was clear as day. He's driving a Lambo. His buddy's driving a Corvette. Guarantee you they were racing somewhere in Texas, Dallas, wherever the hell they were. And the dude lost control because, again, you're like 20-something years old, 23 years old. You don't have a lot of experience driving. I mean, did you really drive a lot while you were in college, living on campus as a football player? Probably not. So all the driving experience you have is either if you had a car in high school or when you got your license and a little bit, you know, in college, maybe in the summers or something. So not experienced drivers at all. And he loses control driving a Lambo, probably at 150 miles an hour, whatever the hell he was doing, I'm sure. And, you know, he hit the center median wall, which caused, of course, a chain reaction collision involving 4 other vehicles. And instead of staying at the scene and owning his mistake and waiting for police and saying, listen, I screwed up. I'm an NFL player. I just won a Super Bowl. Like a lot of times you'll hear like these hard-nosed cops that are just, you know, a-holes that don't give a crap who you are. But most of the time you tell somebody that you're a professional athlete, they're not going to like take it easy on you, but at least it de-escalates the situation. And it's like, all right, obviously you're a high profile person. You're going to have a good lawyer, like just relax. This is going to be fine, whatever. But instead, Rice and his buddy ran from the scene. They left his car there. They just left the cars there and ran. didn't think that through quite right, did you? Because they found the registration, saw the car was registered to him, and that's when he got his hand caught in the cookie jar and had to confess, like, days later. And I heard, like, Andy Reid and the, you know, top brass with the Chiefs were not happy at all that this guy was not cooperating at the beginning with the police. But it's hilarious because, you know, he's got this lawyer who's also a senator that's coming out and saying, oh, we shouldn't judge these, you know, we shouldn't judge him based on this one mistake and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think I saw it on Reddit and people were laughing. It's like, dude, it says a lot about a person if they're going to flee the scene of a crime or an accident in which people got hurt. Now he's all remorseful and he's just praying for these families and these victims. You know, a couple people with minor injuries, a couple went to the hospital, nothing crazy, thank God. But he's, you know, hoping for that everyone has a full recovery from this. I'd sue the crap out of him if I was in that, if I was part of that accident. I'd be like, oh, you want to be flashy and show off your, you know, your nice Lambo. I'm going to sue you now for damages. And that's it, you know, and restitution. And that could end up happening for sure. But just these football players, man, these athletes, just as quickly as you gain it, which isn't all that quick because, you know, you have to grind and put in work for 20 some odd years before you can go pro in any of these sports, just about. And to just try to almost throw it away in an instant like that. Like, look at Henry Ruggs. He's a guy in prison. Threw it away in an absolute instant. Because he was driving in Vegas at 140 miles an hour and he killed a woman and her dog, just derailed them. And of course, he was wasted out of his mind and he walks away without a scratch. Just gotta love it. I would never, who likes driving? Okay. Who likes driving? You know, the traffic every day, the amount of just awful drivers. I keep saying this. If I survive and live till I'm like 90, like a lot of people in my family. I have really good genes. It'll be a blessing. But every day I get on that road and I get behind the wheel of the car and I see worse drivers every single day. And I say it'll be a miracle if I don't get killed in a car accident because of some stupid moron that's either on their phone or texting or changing the dial on the radio or doing their makeup or whatever the case may be, not paying attention. That's why we need the damn self-driving cars so that no one has to drive and a machine can drive and they'll never get into an accident whatsoever. But yeah, it's just the stupidity. I'd have a driver if I was that rich and a professional athlete. I'd be like, oh, I'm a wide receiver. I can't drive my own car because I need to catch the ball with my fingers. And God forbid I do get in an accident and I break a finger or whatever. You know, that's something that would go through my mind. I would have a person and you know, I'm kind of petty this way. So my personal driver, it wouldn't be some rando that I hired. No, it would be one of my siblings. I would just pay them to be my chauffeur and be, you know, my slave basically. Cause I'd be like, well, you know, why not? And, you know, I wouldn't like treat them badly, but I think that would be cool to have, like, you know, your sibling or somebody like that just with you all the time. Cause I know, especially my brother, he loves to, you know, he's actually one of those people that is always like the designated driver, no matter like anywhere you go, like he's got to be the one driving, which I'm okay with cause I don't care to drive, whatever, but he would actually probably enjoy, you know, being the driver, driving me around everywhere I needed to go. So, you know, that's what I would do. I would never drive anywhere. I'd always have a driver for sure. All right, this episode ran pretty late, but and I want to get to these final four games. So we're at the end. That's it. On this date in sports, April 5th, 1984, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar breaks Wilt Chamberlain's all-time career scoring record of 31,419 points. Obviously, it's a lot higher than that now. And LeBron just passed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, first player. Well, no, he didn't just pass Kareem, but he's the first player to surpass 40,000 points. So he blew past Kareem's scoring record, which, you know, throughout most of my life, it was like, wow, this record's never going to get broken. And, you know, it just shows the greatness that LeBron is. He's not on the level of MJ, obviously, but still pretty cool. But yeah, April 5th, 1984, that was 8 years before I was even born. So that's pretty crazy. And then, okay, last thing, what's on TV this weekend? You know, it could be a little bit of a rainy weekend. We're not going to start to see really nice weather until next week and next weekend, early next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're going to see weather in the 70s. And then again on Sunday, it'll be in the 70s, which is finally. But if you're stuck inside this weekend, we've got the women's Final Four. That's obviously tonight. NC State, South Carolina. That game's on right now, actually. That started an hour ago. I thought it was on at 8 or 8:30, but that actually already started. So let me see what the score of that is. Yeah, South Carolina's up by 12. I figured that would be a blowout. That's midway through the third quarter right now. My gut told me to bet South Carolina, but then, you know, I just had that weird thing in my head telling me, don't sleep on NC State. But especially you have that undefeated team. It's like very easy to go undefeated and not end up winning that championship, but they are the team to beat. So they're up 12. That game's on now. You got UConn, Iowa. That's on at 9:30. That'll follow this game. That's on ESPN. That's the one I want to watch. Then you have the women's national championship. What a terrible time to have this on, but luckily most people, I should say, we'll be home and we'll be able to watch this game at 3 p.m. I will not be able to see this game because we're actually playing games on Sunday starting at 12 o'clock, about an hour away. So I probably will miss most of this game, although I might get to watch some of it on the bus ride home. So that should be fine. And then you've got the men's Final Four. That's tomorrow. You've got 11 NC State versus number one Purdue. That will be on TNT at 6:09 p.m. And then the Alabama UConn game, that's the four versus the one, that will follow that game on TNT at approximately 8:49. These games are late. I really hope the national championship game is a little bit earlier this year because that's always an issue too. But yeah, that's what's on this weekend. Of course, baseball you've got on. You know, there's softball across ESPN networks. I'm sure there's golf on again this weekend. There's everything going on. There's NHL. I didn't even talk about that wild start to the Devils and Rangers game, which was building up over, you know, a period of games that they have played each other that have been a little bit chippy. Everybody dropped their gloves as soon as the puck dropped, essentially, and everybody was fighting each other, which was a wild scene. Devils lost that 4-3. But yeah, so the hockey season's coming to a close. Basketball season's coming to a close. Baseball's just starting. And we've got the Final Four taking place this weekend. So good stuff. I'm excited. I hope you appreciated this episode. I'm finally back after a one-week hiatus. That's why it was a little longer. I was glad to be able to bring this to you. And I hope you enjoy your weekend and watch some sports and go Yankees. Hopefully they can get a couple wins against the Blue Jays this weekend. And then we got the solar eclipse Monday. I know the Yankee game was moved back for that. Make sure you've got your glasses, those little solar eclipse, like 3D goggles, whatever the hell they are. And don't look at the sun. I don't plan on looking at it. I'm sure people will take high res photos and videos, NASA and different places like that. I'll just see it on Instagram or TikTok or wherever. So, and again, if you were someone like me that experienced that earthquake today, hopefully everybody's okay. 4.8 in the grand scheme of things is nothing like the one they just had in Taiwan, in which buildings literally collapsed on their side. Looked like the Leaning Tower of Pisa over there. I'm sure people died and there was some serious damage sustained. So just hope everybody's safe and made it through that earthquake. It was a weird experience. I'm glad I did experience it because it's cool to kind of feel that for the first time, or at least once in my lifetime, to know what an actual earthquake feels like. But it was definitely different and weird, and I don't think I liked it, and I don't want to experience it again. But I saw you could have aftershocks up to a month after the fact, so might not be the last we saw of those. I appreciate everyone for tuning in and listening. I'm the Pody, signing off. This has been episode 239 of This Week in Sports. Later.